Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
The Bay Area, as you probably know, is an epicenter for drug legalization efforts, and many people here believe that they can function quite well, even at work, while on drugs, or at least they rationalize they can. Drug abuse in the workplace. What does the data and experience suggest for substance users? What does it suggest for their coworkers and their bosses? What works in curbing abuse? With me is Paula Wilburn. She is a psychologist. She treats veterans with substance abuse problems at the VA in Menlo Park. And she is a coordinator of a national VA substance abuse program. It kind of focuses on, you know, not just what works intuitively, but what works in based on partly on data and partly on intuition. So she knows a lot. And I used to drug one of my many previous incarnations. I was a drug counselor as well. So I'm excited about having this conversation with Paula Wilburn. Paula, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you.
So, is there decent data? Let's start with this. How big a problem is substance abuse in the workplace? Do you have any data on how big a problem it is in the American workplace?
There's really good data on this, and it is a big problem in the workplace. There's estimates that cost of drug and alcohol use in the U.S. can go up to $275 billion. Part of the issue, I think, that makes it really concerning is sometimes substance use happens at work. So it's not just something that happens off the clock. It happens while people are at work. And it leads to something like 500 million days of missed work.
Wow. Now, I can't imagine it's, you know, equally distributed across all industries, across all job titles. Where is the problem most prevalent?
Well, what we can talk about, we can think about places where it's more prevalent and individuals for whom it's more likely to happen. So in general, it's more likely to happen in men are more likely to use drugs and alcohol than women. It happens more often in younger adults than older adults. It happens more often in those making less than, say, $20,000 a year, more so than those making more than, like, $75,000 a year. So there are places and individuals who are more likely to use. And there are industries also where that people are, there's a more of a problem for substance use. And so you see it more in, you see alcohol use more commonly and drug abuse too in recreation, food service. You also see it more in construction, mining. You see it more in late shift workers than people who work during the day.
I had, years ago, I'd heard that part of the problem with American cars is that a lot of there was the Monday morning car, and the people would come in, you know, either with a hangover or were doing drugs or alcohol on the job. And I went to a party just 2 weeks ago, and I happened to meet a guy who worked at a Ford plant in Detroit, Dearborn or whatever. He's here now, but he was at a party here. I guess it was somebody's 70th birthday, and he'd flown out or whatever. And I don't really know if he still works there. It could be a few years ago. It could be 10 years ago. It could be now. I'm not really sure. But he said he was like laughing. He said, you know, he was on the floor. He was a welder. I guess this was, you know, supplementing the robotic welders. They do some hand welding too. And he said, you know, we had the most fun. You know, we were always stoned, man. And you know what we did is we took the axles, and they had two parts, man. You know, we used to put a Coke can in the axle, and then we would kind of get it shut. And so when they tried to get through QC quality control is a joke, man. It's a joke, man. There was a thing, the can was rattling around, and then they couldn't figure out what it is. It was so cool. We would do this all the time. Oh, and then one time we put a dead rat in there, and then the smell, you know, it didn't smell right away. But then by the time the owner got it, it was a smell, and then it couldn't even figure. How prevalent a problem, and we always hear about quality control problems in America versus, for example, Japanese products. Do you have any idea at all how serious our drug and substance alcohol abuse problems are in American manufacturing that is contributing to our difficulty in competing in the global economy?
Well, what I can say are there are the industries where there are higher rates, and those are really construction, mining, entertainment sorts of industries. But what you do see overall, when drugs and alcohol are a concern, what you see are increases in absenteeism, increased risk-taking, more injuries. Those are the kinds of things. Paying attention to the risks, paying attention, doing a good job, productivity are all things that are impacted by drugs and alcohol when they happen.
You work for the VA. To what extent is substance abuse a serious problem in the military? Clearly, they're handling large weapons. We always hear about, you know, friendly fire, people getting killed, your own planes dropping down because of errors. How much is substance abuse a problem in the military?
Well, what I can tell you, I haven't worked with DOD, so I haven't worked with active duty military. I have worked in the VA. And what I can tell you about veterans is that the rates of substance use in veterans are very similar to the rates of substance use in the rest of the United States population. And there are those individuals that are at a bit of a greater risk for substance use than others, but it's not necessarily about being in the military or being in the VA. It's more about, you know, younger adults versus older adults, that kind of thing.
You know, I want to take the other side. I was kind of, you know, sad. I was doing it to try to imitate what the guy was really like when I was talking. But, you know, of course, it's sad. But on the other hand, there are some people I know, including some of my career counseling clients, who insist that they can work as well or better under the influence of a substance, certainly in the arts, but also otherwise. Is there any data to support or refute that claim?
Well, let me say, I've met those individuals, too, who have a deep conviction that this is helpful to them. But I can say what the data says is that substance use in the workplace is related to those problems that we talked about, absenteeism, lack of productivity, increased risks for injury. And it's not just the person who uses the drugs or alcohol. It's also the coworkers. So the coworkers report feeling, have a worse attitude, feel discouraged, feel like they have to do more work or redo work to make up for the guy who's putting the Coke can in the axle or what have you. But they report negative impacts related to substance use. So I'm not aware of any data that says there's any aspect of work that's enhanced by substance use.
We're going to talk about what coworkers and bosses can do to address the problem, as well as people who may have the problem themselves, help them identify the problem. But first, I want to let you know what you're listening to. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Paula Wilburn. She is a psychologist who treats veterans with substance abuse problems in Menlo Park and is the coordinator of a national VA substance abuse program that prides itself on being both data-driven as well as the art that is involved in any good clinical treatment. Is that a fair summary?
That's a fair summary. We do try to think about science and then think about human beings. How do we both use the best that science has to offer us and connect with the human being who's in front of us and help them build that life that's going to be meaningful and productive to them?
I am very worried. You know, I've been hearing a tremendous move, for example, in Kaiser to evidence-based medicine. It is the buzzword of the decade. And unfortunately, in the year 2012, the quality of the evidence is not sufficiently good as to obviate the need for clinical judgment. There is so much that subjectivity, so much that the averages do not take into account, that I'm very worried about evidence centricity, and I'm much more willing to embrace personally as a, you know, somebody who's a physician who is recognizing that evidence is a part of the equation. As you who spend your life in an evidence-based program, what is your honest reaction to what I've just said?
When I think about that provider that I want to have working with me, if I have myself or a family member who has a serious concern, I want them to know all of the evidence that's out there. I want them to have the best knowledge of science, and then I want them to think about me as a person, to connect to me, to listen to me, and help me come up with a plan that's going to work for me. So I feel like I'm in a lucky place in substance use treatment where we have good data that it does improve care, and part of what that data tells us is that my hope, my empathy, my compassion are part of what data says is good for the person I work with. So it's a sweet place to be between where science and humanity come together and help me to help that person sitting in front of me.
Apart from empathy, what if I said you only could have three principles or truths or pieces of data, kind of postulates that are data-based, truths about treating substance abuse, what would those be?
What a great question. I think the first one would be connected to motivation and empathy. So connecting with the human being in front of me to help that person feel more confident, more interested, and motivated to make changes. I think that's the number for me. That's a very high priority, important piece of evidence for treating substance use concerns.
Before you go to the next one, if I were your intern,
yes,
and you told me that, that scares me because I know it's important, but it's ethereal. There are some people who have a natural gift. They're like the Madonnas. They glow. They have this Madonna-like glow, and there's the empathy that it just exudes from every pore. What if somebody is not naturally like that? They care. They really care. But they tend to be more intellectualized, like I tend to be. And I really work at the empathy piece. I was your intern, what would be the one piece of advice you'd give me to make my empathy more manifest?
I might say something like, think of the things you've struggled with. Think of how you felt when you walk into a mental health you imagine yourself walking into a mental health provider. You're going in there to talk about the places where you failed, where you've suffered, where you're the most ashamed. Think about what it's like to be in that person's skin. And now your job is communicate to them that you understand, that you hear them, and you have willingness to embrace their truth, and you're hopeful for their future.
I think that's a fabulous answer. And so I want to make sure it stays in my listeners' minds. I'm going to paraphrase it and you see if I've got it right. Okay. You know, it's so easy if I'm a therapist to, or a doctor or whatever, to just think about my data or think about whatever. But if I'm worried about whether I'm going to be sufficiently empathic, what's critical is to put myself in their shoes, to think back to the situations myself when I had to go to a therapist or a doctor. I revealed something that was scary to me, that was very intimate. How would I want that doctor or therapist to behave and feel? Is that fair?
That's perfect.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
So let's go to the net. You said, I asked you, the challenge I gave you was three data-based truths, if you will, or close to truths, about how best to address substance abuse. What would be the other two?
It's hard to pick, but I think the next one might be a focus on skills. So a focus on skills that help the person manage their own feelings better, manage situations where they might use and now they're going to try not to use.
Give me two examples of skills.
A skill could be communication skills. So a perfect one is drink refusal skills. What are you going to do? You want to cut back, you're in recovery, and you're walking into a party. So one thing I'll practice with someone in treatment is specific ways to say, oh, no thanks, I've had enough, I'm having some coffee, I have to drive, to really have that answer on the tip of their tongue that's going to allow them to get through that situation without using drugs or alcohol.
Yeah, so asking me another skill, that's good. Tell me
another skill. Another skill could be, sometimes when I'm doing skills, I'm talking to family members and I'm teaching them skills because most of us aren't born with a book on how do you handle substance use in someone you love. And so the skills I'm working on there are, how do I support this person in recovery for drug and alcohol use. So one example is praising them when they're sober. Another example is giving them engaging in activities that exclude drugs and alcohol. So it may mean going to church, doing at sports where it's really hard to drink or use. So teaching those family members how to communicate and how to support a life that includes recovery from drug and alcohol use.
What's one more skill, before we get to the third, one more skill you would not teach family members? Let's focus, because this show focuses on work.
Mm-hmm.
What would be a skill you'd want to give? If I was somebody who was abusing a drug, I was high at work, either stoned or high at work, or drunk, what would be one skill you'd want to teach me?
Teach you as the employee?
As the employee.
I would want to teach you alternatives. So when I think about that person who's using at work, I want to ask them, well, why are they doing this? What are they getting out of it? So if they're doing it to manage stress, I want to teach them a skill to manage the stress without the substance use.
What's a great stress-reducing tool, skill that you use successfully, or the data suggests is successful?
It really depends on the person. So it could be a person who needs to get more sleep or needs to manage their anxiety or needs to be better at socializing at work. So it's
Let me give you an example.
Yeah.
This is, to me, the prototypical. If I'm subsuming all of the complaints I've gotten from clients who might be so stressed at work. Very often it comes to feeling incompetent, hating a coworker, or hating their boss, And so those are very work-centric. So let's say I come to you and I'm your client, and if I'm brave enough to admit, you know, I'm not sure I really know what the hell I'm doing. I BS'd my way into the job. I lied about my IT skills or whatever, that I was a good team player. And I hate being a team player. I hate my boss. I hate my coworkers. Man, I can't make it through the damn day. And so I go and I'm going to get high. The only way I can get through the day is smoke a joint.
Right.
Okay. Does that sound realistic?
Sure. Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I can imagine that person being
okay.
very real.
I've just kind of aggregated a number of people there in that one story.
Yeah.
But if I were your client, patient, whatever, your customer, whatever you want to call, what do you guys call them these days?
Well, I often call them veterans because that's where I work. But, yeah.
Okay, yeah. One of those people. You were my therapist, counselor, whatever. And I came to you, I presented with that story.
Mm-hmm.
What would you tell me to how to deal with that stress?
What I would start with is, honestly, I'd ask you, what do you think you need to do? What do you think you need to get through work without substance use? But part of that might be, say you said, it's I can't talk to my boss. I hate my boss. Let's take that piece of what you said. That person, I'm going to think about, you know, asking if you'd be interested in some communication skills that might help you navigate those relationships. You know, share your concerns with your boss without being, you know, so angry that you can't contain yourself.
Well, very often the problem, as I said, is core skills. Probably the reason the boss hates me is because I'm not that good at what I'm doing. He or she is very frustrated with my lack of IT skills or my whatever. But I can't afford to quit because I, you know, in this job market, man, I'm not going to get a job. So, you know, that's usually the core of it.
What I would say to that person is I'm not thinking about skills. And when you start saying that to me is I say, look, there's something about you that they hired you. And if nothing else, you're doing a great job for a guy who doesn't know that much about what he's doing. You're doing a great job by showing up every day. So I'm going to work actually on your confidence that you know something, that you have something to bring to bear, and that's useful to you in facing that situation on a daily basis.
You know what I'll tell you? I wouldn't, if I was the counselor, I wouldn't know. I would say, I know you can't afford to quit now because you're going to be broke or homeless or whatever. You need to get out of this job because you can BS your way all you want and try to communicate your way. Communication is a great and critical skill, but it doesn't solve. If you don't have the skill, you BS your way into the job, you know, great. You can do that, but you can't, you know, it's unfair to your coworkers, to the company, to everything. You've got to start, look, let's figure out a job where God would say you are qualified to do the job, and let's go and find you that job, and then you'll quit.
Well, and I think that's a great answer. That's a great solution, especially from someone who's thinking about employment. I'm thinking a little bit about psychological functioning, but absolutely, if it's absolutely honestly true that person doesn't have the skills, then VOTEC skills and a change in position make a lot of sense.
Okay, let's go back. I have this little outline in my brain.
Uh-huh.
So I was saying that there were three different database truths or near mm-hmm. truths related to this, and we talked about the empathy, we talked about teaching skills was number two. What's the third data-based must that's truth about helping people with abuse?
I would say that I would say that there's no single answer for everybody. So when we look at effective treatments, the good news is there's lots of choices. So there's no single treatment of choice. There's different treatments are going to work for different people. And so what I think about when I meet a person is there's 50 ways to leave your lover, and our job together is to find the one that's going to work for you.
What's the smorgasbord? If you were to tick off, you know, you mentioned a few. Mm-hmm. What's, you know, I noticed you haven't mentioned, for example, antabuse. There are various drugs that are used to help people, cure people from drugs. What's the data on the efficacy of antabuse? And it's a drug that makes you feel sick after 10 minutes after you drink alcohol.
Yeah.
And I think it's also supposed to work for cocaine as well. What does the data say about the use of the drug abuse stopping drugs?
Right. You gave me three choices, and I would say pharmacotherapy was probably going to be my fourth reply. And there are great pharmacotherapies for helping people cut back, whether it's drugs for alcohol use disorders or for opiate use problems. I actually really love disulfiram. I think it's a medication.
That's the chemical name for antabuse. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I love that medication. I think it's most effectively used in the context of relationships. So, for example, if a veteran comes in and they've got a spouse and that spouse is very concerned about the recovery and supportive of the recovery, one of the ways we'll use that drug most effectively is for that couple to sit down in the morning, and the veteran, I'll train them to say something like, you know, honey, I'm committed to not drinking today, and I really appreciate your support and your patience with my recovery. And I train the spouse to say, thank you. for choosing sobriety today, and that's a little moment, it takes 30 seconds, they take that pill, and that's a way of using Anabuse in sort of the more modern incarnations of that drug. That's actually an older medication.
1924, I think, is when it was first developed. So I actually like older drugs because they, you know, they're not going to make you have a side effect of having three heads. You know, they've been around long enough.
There's other medications, too, that some provide. Sometimes Anabuse is a little bit tricky because it does make you violently ill. So there are people who, when you drink alcohol, so there are people who shy away from that. It's a little scary, but we have other medications, more modern medications. Naltrexone, acamprosate, that don't have those, you know, that dramatic effect of making you tremendously ill, but are very effective in helping folks with alcohol use problems, for example.
Now, you know, the reality is, I mean, drug and alcohol abuse has been studied for a million years. I was a drug counselor in the 70s. You know, and the reality is in 2012, the number of people who get off the wagon, who have, you know, come clean and sober, and they stay their way for a month, 2 months, 3 months, a year, and then they're back again. Why the high recurrence rate?
I would say it's actually a normal recurrence rate. When you think of any chronic, serious thing you have to make a change in, whether it's weight, whether it's managing diabetes, whether it's saving more money, whatever change you're trying to make in your life, often it's the case, if it's a chronic health concern, that it waxes and it wanes. And that's the very same for substance use. There are times when people will do really well. There'll be times when people, for whatever reason, will fall off the wagon. And my job as a provider is to be there, right there with them, to help them make that choice to get back on the wagon, to stick with it and hang in there. And so in my mind, it's actually sort of normal that those symptoms may come back and then they may go away again.
I want to ask another question about treatment modalities. I tend to divide the treatment modalities for drug abuse into two categories. There's the more spiritually oriented, emotion-centric, relationship-centric ones that are defined by, for example, 12-step programs. You know, you have surrender to the higher power and the spirit, all that stuff. And those, in my judgment, on average, and I'm going to use the technical term because you're a PhD, there's something called an aptitude by treatment interaction, which means that if you are somebody who by nature lives your life more based on emotion than on rational analysis, you will do, and especially if you're religious, you will tend to do, and you're social, you will tend to do better in a 12-step program. If you are more analytical, intellectual, on average, you're going to do better with the cognitive behavioral approaches, correcting your erroneous thinking about that you really are cooler when you're high and correcting the misconceptions, and then behavioral solutions like the skills. Do you buy my analysis that in the way you say there's 50 ways to leave a lover, that the 12-step-like programs are better for the more emotion-centric people, and the cognitive behavioral therapy approaches like REBT, rational emotive behavioral therapy, are better for the analytic people? Do you buy that analysis?
Here's what's interesting is a lot of people bought that analysis, and they put a ton of money into a huge study thinking, okay, we've got these good treatments, and all we have to do is to figure out how to match people to them. And the deal is, you know, the best minds, tons of money, huge study, and they found pretty much no results. And the answer that we come
up with... No results means that it didn't matter.
It didn't matter. You couldn't predict who was going to do better in what. And so what we've come to sort of understand is, like, we've got great options for treatments. And what people need is access to those treatments. If they don't need the perfect match, they need to have the autonomy to say what they need and say what they need to be listened to. But it's not the case that we have a treatment of choice or we have any reason to think one treatment's going to be better for one person and I can identify who that's going to be.
In light of what you said, I'm wondering whether the smartest approach is the buffet, the smorgasbord, to say we have a one-stop shop here. We have a 12-step-like program. We have a behavioral program. We have a group program. We have individual. We have skill. We have tough love programs. Here are the five programs. And there is no data that suggests which one is best. You need to self-select based on your intuition about what will work best for you. What do you think about that?
There's a little data that says self-selection is a good way to do it. Mm-hmm. Pragmatically, though, if I think of myself as an administrator, I may not be able to put all those things in one place.
Why not?
Because it takes a ton of skill. These things are actually hard to learn to do. And so training people, recruiting those resources to have every option available is tricky.
I'm going to push back.
Okay.
If I had your job,
yes,
because you supervise a number of centers, there are mental health centers of the VA has throughout the country. I would start and I would take one such center. Since you're in Menlo Park, I'd take Menlo Park. And let's say I'm under severe budget constraints, so I'm not going to be asking for all kinds of huge money. But when I look at my staffing, I want to make sure, how many people are on, how many people provide counseling services at that Menlo Park place?
Oh, that's a tricky question.
How many FTEs, roughly? How full-time equivalent people, ballpark?
I'm just pulling this out of the air. Throughout all of substance use, I would say probably 40.
Perfect.
But those are divided between residential care, acute inpatient. Okay.
But what my point is, I'd want to make sure that there was a well-represented assortment of all of those treatment modalities I just meant among the 40, and then have very detailed, I'd have the information there, the bios of each of those 40 people, say what their métier is, what their specialty is, and allow, therefore, when a client comes through intake, they can read the bios and make a request of their first, second, third choice person, thereby doing the self-selection without any additional cost.
That sounds like I can see the appeal of what you're talking about. I would say that a program develops a culture, and part of what may work about a particular approach is having things that synergistically work together. So multiple counselors, multiple voices that give voice to that approach.
You've got 40 people. You've got seven modalities. You have five people. There's going to be enough of that synergy from that. Everything you say, when you're talking about data, if you really are an empirical data-driven person and there really is no data about what is best, and self-selection, there is some good data, why wouldn't you try a pilot in one place where you couldn't fire people? It's the government.
Right.
But you can, as you do make changes, you do try to make sure that there is more of those balances, and you do make an easy either website or handout or whatever that makes clear that people have those choices and allow self-selection and collect data to see if the outcomes are better at this one model site versus the others.
Well, and that we do part of that when people come into treatment. We do let people know what we have. We do allow people as much as possible to select into the choices and the different kinds of treatments we have available. So there, that is a part of what happens when somebody walks into a treatment center.
Let's turn now to the specifics about what individuals should do. We've talked about general modalities.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my clients who tell me, even if they tell me they smoke pot every day, they do not think they have a problem. I mean, it's the classic thing. Most people who have a problem don't think so. Everybody tells them they don't have a, they don't, they can handle it. It's a cliche. How does one, let's say I filled this room right now with people who are saying, I don't have a problem. I'm cool.
Mm-hmm.
How would you try to get them to self-assess in a way that gets them to accept that they have a problem?
I love it. That's one of my favorite things to do. So I would talk to that person, and the first question in my mouth is going to be, so if we're talking about, say, alcohol use or marijuana use, well, what do you like about it? What do you enjoy about it?
We're going to role play.
Okay.
Of course, it feels good, man. I'm relaxed. I can be social. I'm comfortable, man. It's good. I can get through the work day.
Mm-hmm. You like it because you can relax. It helps you socialize, and it can get you through work.
Exactly.
Tell me some of the things that are maybe not so good about your substance use. What things have you noticed?
I don't know. My boss tells me use a fancy term, amotivational syndrome. I'm just not doing that much work, I guess. My memory isn't quite as good as it was.
So you've noticed that your memory may not be as sharp as it once was.
Yeah, but I can't worry about the long term, dude. I just got to get through the day.
So you're trying to get through the day, and part of what's happening is your boss is telling you some too about how you may not be getting as much done as he'd like you to be getting.
Yeah, I know, but I'm not a machine, man. I'm not about getting everything done all the time. I got to have some, I can't be this stressed out,
Mm-hmm. So it's important to you to manage your stress. On the one hand, you feel like your substance use helps you feel better.
Yeah.
It helps you relax. It helps you get through the day.
I love it. I just love it. The joint is great. It's wonderful.
On the other hand, you have noticed that your memory isn't as sharp as mm-hmm. it has been, and you notice that you are kind of getting some heat from your boss about this.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about that, what do you think you'd like to do about it?
I don't know, man. I don't know. We all like cheeseburgers better than we like broccoli, man. And we know we should be eating the cheeseburgers, but most of the time it feels too good. I'd rather have the cheeseburger or the joint and say, oh, I'm a good little doobie worker,
So you're not so sure what you'd like to do.
Right.
You can see at one level, you know we all should choose the things that are best for us, and you see the appeal of going down a different road. Tell me what it would look like. what are some other options you might have if you were to think about making a change to get some of that feeling good, some of the relaxation? What are some other ways you might accomplish those things that maybe don't have, they're not going to get you in so much hot water with your boss? Mm-hmm. What could you do instead?
I mean, I heard of somebody getting high on life, you know, relationships and, you know, feeling accomplishment and enjoying nature, you know, but nature's so much more fun when you're high, you know?
So you've
music
heard...
is so much fun. Eating is so much fun. Sex is so much more fun when you're high, you know?
Well, so there's some things in your life that you can identify. Your relationships, nature, your sex life, things that you enjoy that might get you some of those good feelings.
Okay, I'll stop there.
Yeah.
I think that's very useful role play. Hopefully people got to... What's the takeaway? What do you want my listeners who may be a coworker, a boss, a loved one, talking to somebody, what's the big takeaway in terms of getting them to accept that they have a problem? What do you want them to remember?
I think the issue is to remember that it's that person's perspective that matters most. I mean, this is tricky. You're kind of asking, can an employer go in and be a drug counselor?
I was going to ask you about that. That was the next question.
That's a little bit of a hard role to be in.
Absolutely.
So what I was doing with you may be a lot to ask a listener or a coworker or a boss to do with someone. But
a loved
I guess
one too? Who could do that? Could a loved one do that, or is this really left for a professional?
I think that those things, what I was doing, I was very strategically listening for your perspective, your concerns. You told me, well, I've got, you know, my sex life, my eating, listening to music, and then you threw in the substance use, and I was strategically trying to polish up the things in your life that you've enjoyed that might compete with substance use. And that's a hard thing to do. It's a hard skill to learn for someone just, you know, coming to the situation. I think coworkers and employers, I think the things you can be doing are expressing concern, respecting and maybe not doing
things.
Let's
role play that.
Yeah.
So let's say you're my boss. I know you're not a lawyer, so you can't know about what's legal to do or not legal to do, but let's pretend that you are my boss. And first of all, let's go back just a step. What signs should I be looking for that suggest not just incompetence or, you know, laziness, but that the problem is a drug problem or a substance problem, or should I not try to be diagnostician that way as a boss?
You know, the Department of Labor has a great list of things for employers to look for and coworkers to look for. Things like inconsistent work quality, lower productivity, absenteeism, taking longer lunches, taking off early, not showing up for several days at a time. Carelessness, things that look like risk management, so being careless, not paying attention to safety, are all part of the signs that you might want to be concerned about substance use.
All right, so let's say I see some of those. And of course, it's hard to... There are some people who are just, frankly, we don't like to use the word, but there are lazier people. Or people who have personal lives that are so complicated, they've got, you know, five kids and they've got, you know, all kinds of issues. So it's really hard to parse out how much is intrinsic laziness versus drug-induced, and sometimes they overlap. But let's assume I see those, and I'm at least thinking that at least a partial contributor to that inconsistent performance, for example, is drug abuse. Now you're my boss. What do you do?
Well, in that moment, before we come to the situation, ideally, there's some sort of policy in place. So as an employer, you don't want to be coming into that situation, and the first time I've thought about how I'm going to handle drug use in the workplace is the moment, the first time I see someone I'm concerned about. So hopefully you have some kind of a drug-free work, you know, workforce or workplace initiative in place where you've thought this through. You kind of know what your audience is, what your interventions are, what your consequences might be, so that you're not just out there on a limb on your own. But let's say I have that, you know, drug-free workplace initiative in place and I've got good resources in place, I'm going to come
and
in.
And even if you don't, if your workplace doesn't, you can Google that, and I'm sure there are drug-free workplace guidelines all up the yin-yang.
Yes, there are.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, there are. So I'm going to say, you know, Marty, I'm concerned about you, and I noticed, you know, you've had a lot going on lately, and, you know, how do you think things have been going at work? What's been going on with you?
You're all right.
So you feel like things are going okay?
They're okay.
Yeah. Would it be okay with you if I share some of the things I've noticed and I'm a little worried about?
What am I supposed to say, no?
Well, you know, I just want you to know that we're in this together, and I'm concerned about you. And so, you know, I've noticed there's been a couple of times lately that, you know, you've been late to work, and times when I think you're not as being as cautious and as safe and looking out for your own well-being as I'd like you to be, and
I
wanted
to
check.
I got a lot of personal problems, you know? It's like I got a difficult life. I'm divorced, and I got 3 kids, and, you know, and so I got a lot on my plate.
You do have a lot on your plate. There is a lot going on for you. And what I want you to know is that, you know, I am concerned about you, and we have some resources here available to you. So we have an employee assistance program where you can go in and they can do a little bit of assessment with you. They can talk with you and maybe make a referral.
Good. Let's say most employers or employees work for small business. They don't have any employee assistance program.
I almost put that in. Yeah, that caveat is larger employers are going to be more likely to have that employee assistance program.
Right.
The next thing I would be thinking about are what are the
It's so ironic, by
benefits.
The way, that you know, we tend, especially here in the Bay Area, tend to denigrate corporations, but they're the ones most likely to provide really quite, you know, protections in the workplace, employee workplace benefits, health care, et cetera. Uh-huh. And, you know, there's a little inconsistency there. But anyway, so let's say, right, so you're at a small workplace, there ain't no employee assistance program.
Okay, so we don't have a program. I can then say, you know, have you thought about some of the resources that you may have available to you through your health benefit plan? Because you may be able to find somebody to talk to and get some help with everything that's going on in your life. And my goal here is I want you to succeed. I want to have you here with us. I want to have you here at the top of your game. And I want us to think together about what we can do to get you at the top of your game at work.
Okay, now let's say there are sometimes, I'm going to play the opposite. Sometimes a person really wants somebody to talk with. Mm-hmm. And may even create codependency. And that could be a boss or a coworker or a relationship person. And then that person almost, you know, enables the, you know, they listen so well, they're so empathic, they finally have somebody to talk to, it kind of just keeps them mired in it, and it becomes a pity party. And they, is that, first of all, I don't want to create false problems that don't exist. Is that realistic, what I've just proposed?
Well, the way I would think about it is, for me, I think it's always a gift to listen. It's a kindness to listen to someone, to hear them out. At the same time I'm listening, I'm going to have limits. And so as an employer, for example, if I listen and you tell me you're concerned about your drinking, you're concerned about these stresses, that doesn't mean that there still aren't going to be consequences. And so I'll say, you know, I'm on your side. I want to help you. However, I do need you here on Monday morning. And so that's the trick, the balance of listening and compassion with real consequences that are still going to be in place when you're at work.
I want to ask a variant of the question because it's my board operator, Joanne Marr. She wrote a version of this question, which is just slightly different, but I want to get your separate takes. I'm going to read what she put it up on the board here, and I want to read it to you exactly and see what you think. What advice would you have for friends or family members, and it could be in the workplace or not, of addicts who want to help but end up becoming codependents? People who prop up the addict, but ultimately keep the addict in the same path and the addictive behavior doesn't change.
So what I would say, so the way I like to think of these folks is folks with substance use problems. And I would say that one of the key principles to being healthy and keeping yourself safe and sane when dealing with a substance use concern is to keep those limits in place. And so if you think about, codependence is a funny term because it doesn't have good boundaries about what we really mean by codependence. But sometimes the kind of the folk message behind codependence is this idea that, you know, someone who's not using gets so engulfed in the problems of the person who is using that it becomes an unhealthy situation for both people. And so one of the things I think about for that concerns.
How does that manifest? So if I, and again, I want to stay, if we can, in the workplace, how could a boss or a coworker become unhealthily, quote,
involved,
codependent, involved,
yes,
whatever it is?
Yes.
Tell me, can you paint a picture of that for
sure.
me?
Sure. So I think a coworker, a risk to being a coworker is part of the things coworkers describe as issues. Is so when they are covering for someone, so not letting that person experience the consequences of their behavior, but
cover for them
doing the work, redoing work, so that they're putting out a lot of effort to keep that person going, and in a sense, that keeps the substance use going because they don't experience the consequences. So if a coworker's using and not showing up as a concerned significant other, I don't want to be doing that person's work for them. I don't want to be calling in and covering for them. I want to both be compassionate, listen, and have limits.
Makes perfect sense. Last question. There's, especially here in the Bay Area, there's tremendous controversy about testing, mandatory testing, testing on a, you know, it gets most controversial when it is not applied to all applicants. Do you know what the rules are about drug testing for the workplace, pre-employment or in employment, And do the rules change if a boss suspects the person of using, being under the influence at work?
Well, that's tricky because I'm not a lawyer, so I can't speak to the details of the law of every situation. I think when you survey people about how often drug testing happens, employees tell you about 25 to 30% of the time workplaces do test for substances. So that is a relatively common practice. I think there are some common sense ideas about what happens in the workplace, and that employers do have an obligation to create a safe work environment for coworkers, for customers. And so I think that that gets more urgent in issues when there's public safety involved. So driving, heavy equipment, things where people can get injured, that obligation becomes more pressing.
What do you say? Let's say I am like the millions of people in America, and again, disproportionately, there is greater, for example, marijuana use in the Bay Area than other places. The center for marijuana legalization is here. Mm-hmm. If I am one of the millions of people, and I've had so many clients tell me this, you know, what I do on my time, I'm not high at work, but I smoke pot at home. I use it as my recreation. I like it. And it is no employer's place to go and test me because that marijuana is going to be in my system. I'm not going to be able to pass a drug test unless I'm clean for 2 weeks. What would you tell that angry person who feels it's an unfair invasion of their privacy?
I think I might say something that, they're right, that what they do on their own time is their business. And where employers get concerned are instances where those things start to intrude on the workplace. And so one reason for drug and alcohol testing is to make sure people, when they come to work, are able to do the job that they're being paid to do.
And is there, a fundamental preliminary to that, foundational to that, is I remember reading a series of NIH studies, which they actually did with monkeys, in which they divided the monkeys into three groups. They had one group of monkeys smoke pot every day. They had one group of monkeys smoke pot only on the weekends. And then one group of monkeys not smoke at all. And then they monitored their motivation and their memory.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both, their motivation, I'm talking about during periods when they weren't even smoking.
Weren't high, basically. They weren't actively under the influence.
Right. And there were significant differences. The ones who didn't smoke at all had the best memories and had the most motivation to push a wheel to get food, for example.
Right.
And the ones who smoked every day consistently had the least motivation and the least memory. And when they stopped doing the drug, there was some reversal. So the argument for employers doing drug testing, even if the employee is not high at work, is it is an indicator. Well, I want to finish. It's a little complicated, but I want to explain. It's an indicator that there are problems. Now, the worker could say, hey, if my work is good enough, then why do you need to test me? Well, an employer, for example, it may be good enough, but if he's not living up to his potential, if his work is much lower caliber, certainly pre-employment, shouldn't the employer have a right to know that there's likely going a residual memory or motivational problem?
I think that's an absolutely good point. I don't know if someone's very angry and sitting in front of me, I don't know that I'll try to explain that study, but I think that that's actually the heart of the issue.
That's the one study I know. Is that accurate to your knowledge that there is a decrement, for example, I'm just taking on marijuana, maybe deals with alcohol.
Well,
is there a decrement to memory and motivation long term that accrues from moderate to heavy use of those substances?
Well, and I think you make raise a good issue, which is that there's what happens when someone uses occasionally and then what happens when someone develops a problem. And the hallmark of developing a problem is that substance use starts to impact your family, your work, your relationships. So it is part of having a drug or alcohol problem or drug or alcohol disorder that it starts to impact other areas of your life. So I think that's a very reasonable concern for employers.
I want to go to the phones. I'm not going to let you go.
Okay.
I'm enjoying having you here. Is there something more you want? Let me
yes.
give out the phone number again, and then I want
okay.
you to say it.
Okay.
My dear listeners, I wanted to go through what I felt was the areas I thought was critical for you, my dear listeners, to hear on drug abuse. But I want to give you a chance to describe your particular problem or that of a family, or especially coworkers or a boss or a supervisee in your workplace. So if you or someone you are involved with, professionally especially, but even personally, and you're concerned about an abuse problem, it could be alcohol, it could be pot, it could be crank, it could be anything, this is the time to call, and you're going to get professional advice from a current expert. And I've been a drug counselor in my career and life coaching practice. I deal with this with some clients. So the price is right, zero. So all you need to do is pick up the phone right now. I'm only going to take one or two calls. So if you want to call, you do it now. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now you were going to say something.
Well, I was thinking about things that I think are important to keep in mind in thinking about drug use in the workplace. And one thing that really stands out to me is that there are huge costs involved, there are big risks involved, and it's all preventable. And so that seems like a key point to make in having this discussion around substance use in the workplace is this is a risk that's totally preventable. So it's worth, and we have treatments that work, so it's worth doing something about this.
Well, clearly we struck a chord. All of our lines instantly lighted up. Let's go right to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko, and most importantly, Paula Wilburn from the VA runs a national drug or substance prevention program. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's your question?
Hi, when you're talking about substances, are you including abuse of psychiatric medications, because that's really common now. Mm-hmm. If people feel like just a little bit down or anxious, they're just really overdoing those medications.
Like Xanax kind of things, right? Or yes. Go ahead, Paula.
When I'm talking about the research in illicit drug use and alcohol, I'm really focusing on things that are not prescribed medications. So I'm thinking about cocaine, marijuana, amphetamines, and alcohol. So that's really the research that I'm referencing.
Is there, if somebody who is, let's say, who is prescribed, say, Xanax, an anti-anxiety medication, or some lithium or antidepressant medication, and they're going beyond, you know, let's say they say you can only take 50 milligrams a day, she's taking 100, anything you have, I mean, I think that's what, is that what you're, dear caller, is that what you're, kind of what you're talking about?
Well, not only taking more than a doctor prescribed, but also a lot of doctors are just going overboard. Maybe that patient doesn't need the medication at all. Maybe they're just they're just a little bit down for a little bit,
yeah.
and they're just taking. So do you really want a workplace of employees who go that route instead of maybe just getting some exercise and mm-hmm. taking better care of their health and having a social life, getting a life? I mean, that person's going to be an ongoing problem in your workplace.
Makes great sense to me. Paula, what's your take?
My thought is that choice to take psychiatric medications, I think, is a very personal one that happens between a physician and an individual. And so I respect that process. I do think you make a great point, and that's not your only option. And you've got great options about having a social life, getting some exercise. And when you think about wellness programs at work, the kinds of things that wellness program is going to recommend is socializing, getting out of the house, exercising, eating healthy. And so those are great roads to achieving mental health and, you know, healthy lifestyle.
I'm at the risk of sounding a little bit like a, you know, an exhorting preacher. I swear, dear listeners, if you are depressed or anxious, there really is, in general, before you turn to pharmacological approaches, please, it's amazing how many people, you're not going to become Mr. Happy-Go-Lucky if you're totally anxious, but you will not, can't imagine how much better you will feel if you find a creative outlet, whether it be write or paint or whatever, or try to make a friend or tutor somebody or be a big brother or sister or exercise or appreciate nature. I swear, those, you'll find a hobby, find love.
I think you're getting back to those 50 ways to leave your lover issue. There's a million ways to feel better, and I think medications are one piece of those. It's a legitimate piece, but there's also thousands of ways, reading, hobbies, lots of things you can do that can make yourself feel better.
Paul, I want to thank you very much for the call. I want to get as many calls in as I can. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko, and of course Paula Wilburn from the VA substance abuse specialist. What is your question for Paul?
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It seems to me the biggest risk of taking any kind of drug or alcohol or anything like that at any time is that something unpredictable is going to go wrong. And then you're going to be in a position of potentially facing the authorities, for example, the police, who are going to look into your eyes, and you possibly will not be able to control the ramifications of whatever that person begins to do, and the whole situation, your whole life has the potential to spin out of control in a way that's going to become very, very destructive for you.
When it sounds like you or someone you know has had an experience like, can you tell us what that experience was?
Well, I've had numerous experiences of, for example, buying marijuana from people that I thought I knew or whatever, or came into my life in one way or another. And it turned out to be sabotaged in a very profound way, that it was like dry cleaned and then altered with synthetic chemicals. I mean, I've actually had people try to kill me with this stuff, like felt my lungs collapse. And because I know alternative healing, I've been able to bring it back. But I've gotten into trouble with roommates, in which I was in like a youth hostel. And they were on methamphetamines, and they became imperious at the smallest thing, and then came over and began violence. And then the police were called, and then the police looked into my eyes, and because I had smoked a tiny amount, they began to potentially accuse me of having triggered the whole thing in some way or another, and it became ridiculous. The police will often say that, you know, they won't bother you unless you're doing something wrong, but potentially if they think you're smoking marijuana and that it's in your system, you could just be sitting there minding your own business, and already you're doing something wrong.
I want to thank you very much for the call. The caller's question, though, is about adulterated drugs. Do you have any? Is there any good data on how, apart from whatever dangers exist inherent in the drug as pure, is there any data about the prevalence of adulteration in mind-altering drugs?
Well, I think the place where the data is that when we have medications that are well-researched and well-developed and tightly controlled, we know what's in there. But when you're buying things off the street or buying things, recreational drugs, the caller's absolutely right. You don't know what's been done to it, and you are putting yourself in a vulnerable position.
Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko with Paula Wilburn. What's your question?
Yeah, hi. Both of your last callers were really intense.
I love my listeners. They were great. I appreciate so much the candor. It's wonderful.
Really, sin of verite. I mean, the last brother, I really tell you advice. If you're going to do it the illegal way, which I don't recommend, do it from friends or people you trust. Don't mess with people. Anyway, but the previous caller, previous to him, I really, really applaud, and I want to follow up her tack a little bit. I'm concerned with I'm moving from all pharmaceuticals to all herbs. Because the pharmacy, I'm strictly speaking legal now, but the pharmacy that they treated me, and they did improve my depression, really messed me up in lots of ways, and is still wreaking havoc. For instance, I have restless leg syndrome that won't go away because I tried to take a drug for restless leg syndrome to help with the ADHD. It's a long story. But anyway, what I'm interested in is some kind of database I can look up on the internet and find out what the results are from detoxing from prescription drugs that are legal, like Roloran for restless leg syndrome, like clonazepam, which is diazepine. It's a very heavy drug.
So is Cymbalta, but I want to mention Cymbalta specifically because it has a lot of side effects. I'm going to cut you off, and you can stay on the line and listen, but I want to get Paul. Do you know much about the issue of detoxing from these prescribed drugs, or is that outside of your expertise?
It's a little outside of what we think about when we think about drugs of abuse and alcohol use. But I would say that your provider, your prescribing provider, your pharmacist, they're there as resources for you, as is the PDR. There are resources for you.
You know, really, there are times, of course, that a doctor-prescribed drug is exactly what you should take. But, you know, every drug, unfortunately, in the year 2012, we are still not in an era of high specificity. That is, a drug that may cure your depression is going to cause all, because it's affecting, it's coursing through your entire body. And so there are other effects. So that's why, when in doubt, try these no side effect approaches. Like, I tend to be mildly depressed, not seriously, but I tend to be on the mildly depressed side by nature. But when I put on what I call pump it up music, whether it be gospel, even though I'm an atheist Jew, the right gospel music, or my new philosophy from You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, or something, I am in a great mood. Or if I'm anxious, if I put on box air on a G-string, I am going to be calm. Try any of these low-risk things before you try the pharmacological route, because you know there's no negative side effect to enjoying nature, petting my dog Einstein, or listening to music.
And I actually think the point you make there also translates to substances, which are find the things that make you happy that don't have those costs. So find the music, find the pet, find the relationships, find the activities that provide you with the benefits that you are hoping that drugs and alcohol could provide.
Let's take one more call, and then I want to give you a closing comment. And I've kept you on for the whole hour. I didn't expect to do that. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. Paula Wilborn, what's your question?
Hi, my question is intervention, and you mentioned briefly about setting boundaries and having some limits. As a mother-in-law of a 42-year-old son-in-law who's been using drugs since 16, 17, and attempts to maintain a normal life, goes to work every day as a machinist, but certainly makes errors in judgment with my grandchildren and in his family life. Can you give me some ideas about how I could handle that?
Well, first off, I want to say thank you for your call, and I really can appreciate in your situation how you may care very much about this, and you may be very personally invested and concerned about your grandkids, and I can see how this is a situation you'd be concerned about. I think a couple of things off the top of my head that I can recommend over the radio. There's a great book by Bob Myers, and it's basically Getting Your Loved One Sober for Good, Alternatives to Nagging and Pleading is a fantastic self-help book that's written for folks who are very much in your situation.
What's the title again?
It's Getting Your Loved One Sober for Good, Alternatives to Nagging, Pleading, and Begging, I think.
All you need to do to find that is getting your loved ones to be sober for good.
Yes.
All right.
Right.
Continue.
Another resource that folks find helpful in those situations are things like Al-Anon meetings is another resource that's available in your community that's really a group who's out there to support folks who have loved ones who have right. drug and alcohol problems that may also be of help to you.
I've got to say goodbye to you because we're out of time.
Thanks.
We have just a few seconds left. I want to give you the last word. If there's one thing that you've either said before and you want to really reinforce or something important you want our listeners to remember that you haven't said, what is it?
I think the three things when I think about substance use in the workplace, I would say it's 100% preventable. So this is something that we can do something about. We have fantastic, effective treatment options. And so I think sometimes people feel discouraged when they think about the chronic issue of substance use, but really we have great treatments that are available.
And how do they find them? What is the one? Is there a one-stop website or phone number that is a source for information where to get help?
Is there a one? I don't know of a one-stop phone number. I think there are great. The websites for AA and NA are there. There are meetings all over the place. So there are resources.
For the types that like 12-step programs.
Yes, for the types who like 12-step programs. There's websites like the Drinker's Checkup is a wonderful website for.
Great. I'm out of time, but you got to tell me the website. If somebody's a veteran, because you work for the veterans, if somebody's a veteran and they think they might have a substance problem or they got a family member, what's the website they should go to?
We have two. We have if they're here local in the area, we have a VA Palo Alto Addiction Treatment Services website.
So just Google VA Palo Alto Addiction website, you'll find it.
Yeah, it's a long address. I'm not going to read it to you. And then the second one that I really like is the Veteran Drinkers Checkup.
You mentioned that Veterans Drinkers Checkup. I'm being interruptive because I've tried to cram as much as I can. Thank you very much, Paula Wilburn, for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. And that is the show for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Join me again next Sunday at 11. I'll do 3-minute career makeovers on callers. And so many people dream of a career in voiceover. Seems glamorous, lucrative, and easy. How glamorous, lucrative, and easy really is it? I'll talk with Elaine Clark, author of There's Money Where Your Mouth Is, an insider's guide to careers in voiceover. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us. Growth among those who don't.